We are going to energize the country.
We need to wake up and smell the coffee.
No more Mr. Nice Guy.
Another future's possible, but we've got to fight for it.
Order!
Hello and welcome to the Debated Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Will. And in this episode, I am delighted to be joined by Ian Williams, who is a journalist, a veteran foreign correspondent, and also the author of a fascinating book, Every Breath You Take, China's New Tyranny. Welcome to the podcast, Ian.
Good morning. Thanks very much. Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on. And the first question that I'd like to ask is, this is obviously a very timely book, given what's been happening recently with the coronavirus pandemic. But what was it that specifically prompted you to write the book at this particular point? Was it the pandemic, or was it some of the other things that the Chinese state have been doing?
It goes back a number of years, because I've been working in and out of China now for, 25 years, my last trip being at the end of 2019, just before COVID. And I'd witnessed during that time the way in which digital China, the internet, social networks had rapidly changed from being something which was seen as liberating, as I think they were in most parts of the world, and as seen as a way to hold the Communist Party to account, seen as a way of complaining, seen as a way for people to communicate directly with each other and to say things they hadn't been able to before, to then see it progressively not only censored and undermined, but turned into a weapon by the Communist Party for not only censorship that we're familiar with, but as an instrument of social control. Not only that, but as part of a much wider system of surveillance of the type which I don't think we've seen before.
Mm. Now, you mentioned social media there and the utilization of it by the Chinese state, because it's one of the things that you cover very well in the book, is the strange contrast between social media being used as a propaganda means by the Chinese state, but at the same time, censorship of anything that is critical to the state, anything that may make fun of either Xi Jinping or anything related to the ideology of the state. Do you think that this is something that makes it a bit more difficult to perhaps combat China in a digital age? Because the way that they are using it is in a quite complex way, on the one hand for propaganda and on the other for suppression. Do you think that this makes it a bit more difficult to fully, from a Western point of view, get our heads around how we can deal with the way that they use social media and the internet?
It does. I mean, there are several aspects. One is, of course, the way it's used at home to censor and control, and also increasingly the way it's being used internationally, and the way some of these instruments are being exported, and the way some of them are being used against overseas dissidents, whether they be Tibetans, Uyghurs, or other political critics of the Communist Party. But what we're seeing within China is on an altogether different scale than what we've seen before. I remember going into the country and, you know, the old system was a bit like a Swiss cheese. There were lots of holes in it. You could jump between them. There were a lot of, you could tunnel under the great firewall, as they used to call it. There were ways in which netizens, which was, that's a term which has become a bit hackneyed outside China, but is still used within it. But the way that they were communicating with each other through metaphors, through images, through a whole language of the internet, in order to be able to say things, in order to be able to criticize, in order to be able to poke fun. And when I was there, some of the major stories, whether it was on train crashes or industrial explosions or accidents, a lot of the place, you'd look first at the internet, at social media. Mm. That would be very much the pulse of young China in particular. That's where you'd find out what was going on. But I think what we've seen now is not only a closing of a lot of those holes, a much more tight regulation of the internet in terms of the censorship, in terms of the internet police, in terms of the intimidation of critics, closing down websites, blocking others. But it's gone beyond that and is now being used as a way of monitoring and controlling and pumping out propaganda. I think one example, for instance, is the recruitment of large numbers of internet police, they're called. I mean, a lot of these people work for the internet companies. A lot of it is subcontracted to these companies. But they're not just blocking websites. It's more sophisticated now. They're joining the conversation. They're trying to turn the conversation. And this is much cleverer. It's altogether more challenging for those who want to criticize the regime and for those who are looking for ways of countering it.
Mm. And of course, as you point out in the book, there are many Western companies that have aided and abetted the Chinese state by helping them in certain ways. For example, Apple with its sensor apps in the Chinese App Store, Facebook, its relationship with Beijing is quite apparent in the book, and also the way that Google has interacted with the Chinese state. Do you think then that to properly tackle the repressive measures that are used by the Chinese state, we have to look, you know, at companies that are part of the Western world, that are vital to the Western world, and be a bit firmer with them to make sure that they aren't aiding and abetting the Chinese state in its repression of its own people?
I think we certainly do. And the big technology companies are the worst offenders. The ones you mentioned, they are the ones who appear willing to bend over backwards to appease the Chinese Communist Party in order to get a slice of this mythical market. And I say mythical because a lot of the time it doesn't happen. I mean, there are companies that I'm amazed by the amount of abuse, if you like, that they take. But at the end of the day, they stick around because the promise of the market that they feel they need to be there. I mean, when I was researching this book, I came across myself an instance of Apple censorship. Before writing this book, I wrote a novel called Beijing Smog, where the smog is literal, but also a sort of metaphor for what is real, what is not real. And the hero of that book, if that's the right term, is an internet meme that is posted by a Chinese blogger, goes viral and causes all sorts of issues for all sorts of people, but particularly the Communist Party, which doesn't have a sense of humor. And he, you know, he posts it as a joke, but they don't get the joke, and it creates all sorts of issues. But in the book, the blogger's trying to promote his little game that he creates out of this meme. And so he writes a computer game which consists of little stick aliens coming out from under the big picture of Mao in Tiananmen Square. And the idea is that you have to swat these aliens with a big fly swat, and you do that by manipulating your telephone, your smartphone. Anyway, I thought it would be a great way of promoting the book by creating this game. So I got a friend of mine to do the game, put it up to the Apple store, and then, which is usually quite a straightforward process, but a month later I'd heard nothing. So I chased it, and then eventually I was invited to ring Apple in the United States, whereupon I spoke to a woman at their headquarters there, who told me that although there were no technical issues, it would not be posted on the Chinese store because it was inappropriate content and that it broke local laws. I said, well, it's a game. And I said, can you tell me what content is inappropriate? In what way is it inappropriate, and what laws? And she said, I do not have that information. I do not have, you know, it was like talking to an apparatchik in the Chinese Communist Party. But the more serious thing about that act of censorship is it was always assumed, because that's what Apple told us, that they censored sites when the Chinese drew it to their attention. And otherwise, they weren't proactive. But this case suggests that they are proactive, and they're, you know, busy in advance censoring sites that they think would be offensive to the Communist Party. And I'm particularly critical of Apple in the book because, okay, Zuckerberg, Google, some of the others, we know they don't have much truck with privacy. But Apple makes a big thing. Privacy is a human right. Privacy is something, we're not like the others. We don't do that. But those pledges stop at the Chinese border. And I think that is something which is very distasteful.
Mm. Do you think that partly because of coronavirus, but also some of the human rights abuses that we have seen against the Uyghur people, do you think that the West and Western politicians are finally waking up to the scale of a threat that China can potentially be and already is to the Western world?
I think they are waking up. I mean, I quoted in the book an interview that John Sawyers, who's a former head of MI6, wrote a piece for the Financial Times last summer in the wake of the early stages of the COVID pandemic. And he said in that piece, we have learned more about China in the last 6 months than we have in the previous 6 years. And I thought, well, what have you and your former employer been doing for 6 years? Because it was pretty obvious from early on the sort of person Xi Jinping was, the direction he was going in, the way he was harnessing technology in a manner, chilling manner, that had never happened before, the way he was throwing his weight around internationally, the way he was repressing at home. And it shouldn't really have come as a great surprise. Yes, we saw a side of the Communist Party during the COVID epidemic. We saw the intimidation of Taiwan, the crackdown in Hong Kong, Xinjiang, all these things accelerated last year. But it shouldn't really have come as any surprise. But to answer your question, yes, I think that Western governments are waking up belatedly to this threat. And I think Xinjiang has been instrumental in that because the human rights abuses there are so obscene, they're so egregious. I mean, it doesn't matter how you describe them. And I know there's an active debate over the precise label. Can you describe it as genocide or not? But in the end, I don't think the label matters. Whichever way you look at it, it's obscene. And I think you can't ignore it. And I think it's really been the aspect of China's behavior that more than any other, which has forced people to wake up to where China is going under Xi Jinping.
Mm. And in the book, you make the comparison between Xi and Putin in terms of the fact that initially both were seen as changes to the old guard and perhaps much more friendly figures to the West. And then in both cases, the West has sort of realized that perhaps they aren't the friendly figures that they initially thought. Do you think that the initial open welcoming of arms to both was a sort of like naivete on the part of Western governments? Or do you think that it just simply was that as they have become more established in their respective positions, they have become more open about their intentions in their countries?
I think a lot of it was wishful thinking. You had Putin who emerged from the Yeltsin entourage. But with Xi, there was very little evidence to support the fact he was a reformer. Mm. And yet people leapt upon tiny little things he'd said, the fact he'd visited the States, the fact his father was a reformer. But there was very little evidence to support the fact that he would go in that direction. I think it was very much wishful thinking. And I think that generally in dealing with China, there has been, and there still remains to some extent, an incredible amount of naivety. Naivety tinged with greed, I think, particularly when you look at a lot of the corporate dealings with China and also with the university sector. And again, it's something which they are only just waking up to, but in a lot of cases, not really quickly enough.
Mm. One thing that you also touch upon in the book, and something that I don't think as many people perhaps aware of or have perhaps outside foreign correspondents, of course, looked into in great detail, is the Belt and Road Initiative. For those who aren't aware what that is, could you just explain what it is?
Yeah, well, if you listen to the Chinese propaganda, it's this biggest and extraordinarily generous and benevolent infrastructure fund worth trillions, which is designed to help and lift, improve the economies and the cooperation between countries worldwide. When you look at it more closely, it's a classic neo-colonial enterprise. It's become an umbrella term for all manner of things that China does as part of its foreign policy. The new Silk Road, it was once described, I think sort of Marco Polo would have cringed because it takes into account, you know, there's an Arctic Silk Road, there's a sea bow. I mean, it's an umbrella term for all manner of Chinese foreign policy, but it's become very much an instrument of Chinese geopolitical ambition, a way to bend the world to its will. It's also become a very damaging instrument of debt trap, countries being saddled with huge debts that they can't repay. You know, it seems like it's free. There's none of these pesky conditions they would get from the World Bank, for instance, or Western lenders, which typically require labor, environmental, or other human rights standards to accompany acceptance of the loan. In China, you know, they tout it very much as condition free, but of course it's not condition free. The keenest countries have been the most politically obnoxious. I mean, recently they signed a deal to take the Belt and Road to Syria, of all places, and you have a certain amount of backlash now, because if you look at Myanmar, when the coup took place earlier this year, a lot of the protests were outside the Chinese embassy because, rightly or wrongly, China was seen to be the power behind the military. So I think in my view, it is very much a neo-colonial enterprise, riddled with corruption, lack of transparency, and with the aim of extending Chinese influence. And you see that, for instance, to return to Xinjiang. To me, it's absolutely shocking that some of the biggest Muslim majority countries in the world have either been silent or have actually defended China on this. I mean, that's outrageous. But if you look at these countries more closely, they're also the biggest recipients of money, countries like Pakistan, under the Belt and Road Initiative. So they're locked in, you know, they are locked into this embrace with China, which has made it impossible for them to criticize what is, I think, without doubt, the biggest abuse against the Muslim religion worldwide at the moment.
How do you think Western countries can counter the economic influence that China has through the Belt and Road initiatives on some of the nations that you mentioned? Do you think that there is a way that nations like the UK or Australia or Britain or France can counter the Belt and Road initiative? Or do you think that it's becoming too deep-seated and too ensconced in some of the economies of these countries?
I think there are two aspects there. One is I already see the EU announced just the other day an infrastructure fund, which was pretty clearly directed at competing with China in some of these countries. The US has become more active. I think they realize it was an old term, war by other means, which China has been extraordinarily successful at, using market, investment, trade as instruments of coercion. But I think that countries now realize that they have to engage more economically, especially with emerging countries, with poorer countries. And it's not on the scale yet of what we've seen from China, but there is a realization that they need to do this. I think as well that I wouldn't quite say the Belt and Road is going to implode, but I do think there are big issues with it, which means that it is going to rapidly slow down. There are a lot of countries which are pretty irritated by what's happening. Sri Lanka's had to hand over an entire port in lieu of a loan they could no longer pay. And you're seeing countries becoming increasingly unnerved by the scale of the debts and the prospect of having to hand over piece of their infrastructure as collateral if they're unable to pay loans. And I think you're seeing in the wake of COVID a slowdown in lending by China because they simply don't have the sort of funds they were pumping out before, compounded by an uncertainty whether they'll ever get it back, combined with countries becoming much more cautious and realizing this isn't free money. There are huge political obligations. And there are huge issues in actually repaying it. Now, a lot of the countries on the receiving end, I mean, there is no country which is too odious to become a partner of China. And in many ways, the more authoritarian, the more unpleasant, the more comfortable China feels with them because it can associate with, relate to that sort of regime better. But I do think generally they won't get a free pass in the way they have had before because of the contradictions within the Belt and Road program. And also because I think Western democracies and like-minded democracies, Japan, for instance, comes to mind, which is very active on this front, realize that they have to step up in terms of their aid, assistance and investment.
Now, you mentioned some of the odious regimes that the Chinese are allied to there. And of course, one of the things that we have seen recently due to the developments in Afghanistan has been the Chinese government making overt calls towards the Taliban and also using the United States and the other coalition troops' withdrawal from Afghanistan as a means of threatening countries like Taiwan, putting out messages on social media saying things like, oh, well, the Americans won't help you, Taiwan, because they didn't help the Afghan government, they didn't help Afghanistan. Do you think that this is something that we're going to see more of if countries like the United States aren't more forward thinking and perhaps pushing back a bit more on China? Is China growing in confidence and potentially eyeing up countries that it has for quite a long time seen as enemies and subsidiaries of it, like Taiwan, and being much more aggressive to them, potentially invading or trying to cut them off in some way?
Yeah, I mean, the aggression, verbal as well as the military intimidation against Taiwan has reached incredible levels under Xi Jinping. And I think what's worrying is that he's made, quote unquote, the recovery of Taiwan a key aspect of his rejuvenation of China, his nationalist mission, in a way that previous leaders have been more cautious about. And I am worried about Taiwan. It is significant that when the US and allies had their messy withdrawal from Afghanistan, China reveled in that. The propaganda, not only seeing as the humiliation of the superpower, but also bombarding Taiwan with messages much along the lines of, yes, you can't rely on them. This is an unreliable ally. They've done this to Afghanistan, they'll do it to you. The bigger picture, of course, is although it was a messy withdrawal from Afghanistan, the logic from the American perspective is that it allows them to concentrate on what they see as the more difficult, longer-term, medium-term threats, in China being foremost among them. But Afghanistan's interesting in lots of ways because, yes, China celebrated the Americans leaving and the manner of them leaving. But I think they're very uneasy about having the Taliban back next door, especially just across short border, but just across the border with Xinjiang, where you've got such an egregious abuse of human rights, which is targeting a Muslim minority group.
Now, one of the things that you also touch upon in the book is China having front companies, corporate standard bearers like Huawei. And of course, prior to the pandemic in the UK, we were seeing potentially Huawei being responsible for the 5G networks in the UK and having a massive access to internet in the UK. Why do you think that the British government was willing to work with Huawei when it was evident even before the pandemic and even before the plans were going forward and there was quite a significant backlash from both Conservative and other MPs? Why do you think the government were going ahead with it?
It puzzles me sometimes, Will, to think about that, because to me it's so obvious that there were numerous red lights, warning signs about Huawei. I mean, there is no such thing as a private Chinese company in any meaningful sense of that word. They've always been subject to the reality of Communist Party power and a whole swathe of laws, which means that they have to do the party's bidding. And that has all become even more so under Xi Jinping. But to me, the whole golden era, Cameron, Osborne, and the, you know, the Huawei relationship was part and parcel of that, is astonishing. And I think you look now at what we are seeing with China's behavior at home and internationally, what we now know about Huawei, and you ask yourself, how on earth did we allow ourselves to get so close to this company and even consider allowing them to be part of such critical national infrastructure? I mean, it seems madness. And I think there was a certain amount of naivety. There was an enormous amount of greed. There was a lot of wishful thinking. They set up an organization under GCHQ whose job it was and still is to examine Huawei technology, that persistently told them that they thought they could manage the risk even though they didn't think it was particularly secure. But I think ultimately it was a combination of American pressure, of backbench pressure, and a belated recognition within the government that it that you know, you simply couldn't allow this company to play that role.
We're coming towards the end of the podcast. It's been great to speak to you, Ian, and I have one final question. We've looked a certain amount at coronavirus. We've discussed it a little bit, but not in quite a great deal of detail. But things in the UK are beginning to get a bit better with the vaccine rollout and cases not being quite as high as they have been previously. So when things do finally get back to some semblance of normality as they were prior to the pandemic, what one thing that you haven't been able to do are you most looking forward to being able to do again?
Well, I'm working to get back traveling again, I guess. I used to travel a lot because I like traveling and also for my job. And I can't remember the last time I spent, 18 months without going to an airport. Because, you know, I just can't remember when that last happened. And so, you know, I'm looking forward to getting out and about again. I have another book which I'm working on, which is looking more broadly at China's international behavior. And Taiwan is a key part of that. Mm-hmm. And although I have regularly visited Taiwan over the years, I'm looking forward enormously to getting back there. And, you know, I've got a lot of respect for Taiwan as a, it represents to me, it's an open, diverse, tolerant, liberal, and very successful democracy. It's, you know, it's everything China isn't. That will be high on my list as soon as that becomes possible. But generally, getting back traveling again.
Well, hopefully you will be able to get back traveling again very soon and be able to visit Taiwan again very soon. For people who would like to buy the book and perhaps know more about you and your work, where should people go to either buy the book or to follow what you're writing about and what you're doing at the moment?
I always post my latest stuff on my website, which is www.ianwilliamsauthor.net, which has a lot of the most recent articles, as well as links as to where the books can be bought. I'm a big fan of bookshop.org because a lot of the funds go to small bookshops as an online source, but it's available from all major bookshops.
Excellent. Thank you once again for coming on the podcast.
Thank you, Will. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast. If you've enjoyed it, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, Spotify, Podbeam, and Amazon Music. You can also follow us on Twitter, @DebatedPodcast, like us on Facebook, Debated Podcast, and if you'd like to get in touch with us, whether about appearing on an episode of the podcast or commenting on an episode that you've listened to, you can do so at thedebatedpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you listen to the next one.